All right, now we're in chapter 8 of the book of Daniel. And in chapter 7, Daniel had a dream. And that dream was in the first year of Belshazzar. As we open up this chapter, chapter 8, we are in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. And so this is 2 years after he had that first vision. And that first vision, of course, was more or less a summary or an overview of the four beasts. And these four beasts represented four nations or kingdoms or dynasties, three of which we find historical evidence of. The fourth, we suspect, is futuristic, which means there is no historical evidence that this fourth beast or the information given to us about this fourth beast has ever been fulfilled at any time in human history. Therefore, we expect that it is in the future. Now, as we come into chapter 8, Daniel has another dream, another vision, pertaining to two of those four beasts. Now, as I said, the overview was in chapter 7, but as we go further into Daniel, he's going to get more detail about that vision of the four beasts. Only the detail is going to come through greater pictures, other types of pictures. So in chapter 8, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time, and of course is referring to that one 2 years earlier. I saw in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking that I was in Shushan, or Susa is the name of this city today, on a river in the Persian region, and in the citadel, the fortified area of the palace, in the citadel which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. And this is an actual river today. They no longer call it the Ulai River. It's a different name, but it is still a river that flows through that region. Actually, it's near the Tigris River. Then I lifted my eyes in verse 3 and saw, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. Now, what you have to appreciate about prophecy, especially when you're reading things like this, and you have the tendency to say, what? these are pictures, and Daniel, of course, is looking at these pictures. As we learned from his previous vision, that it troubled him. He didn't really understand it. We see in verse 28 of chapter 7, this is the end of the account. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. He wasn't sure what it all means, and so it was troubling to him. We have a tendency, therefore, when we don't understand things, but these are pretty cool pictures, and what happens very often, especially with the book of Revelation, some really weird and unusual pictures that are given to us in the book of Revelation, as well as here. We tend then to want to, as we say, shoot from the hip. Well, I think it means this, or what I think it means is this. Nobody should care what we think it means. It doesn't matter what we think it means. When it comes to Bible interpretation, there is only one interpretation. I've said this before, and it's up to the student of Scripture to find that interpretation, and the interpretation is God's interpretation, meaning God put it here, so our job is, what do you mean, Lord? And so we have to find out what that is. And there's a whole process of study and how we're able to interpret these things. I'm a believer, a firm believer, that Scripture should be able to interpret itself. It's not always necessarily true when it comes to prophecy, because prophecy is very often very different when it comes to interpreting the verses of prophecy. However, in this particular case, it's absolutely true. Let me show you what I mean. In verse 3, then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns. The two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. Okay, what does that mean? Well, read verse 20. the ram which you saw, having the two horns, well, they are the kings of Media and Persia. Oh, well, that explains it. Do you see how simple that was? Yeah, okay. Really, it sometimes is that simple. And the reason is God wanted Daniel to understand this. He didn't want anyone to be able to shoot from the hip. And believe it or not, with that much clarity, and we're going to see the same thing happens with the next picture, there are people who still don't understand what the vision means, or they want it to mean something else. But this is the reality of it. This ram represents the nation of Medo-Persia dynasty, the people of the Medo-Persian dynasty. You remember we ran into them in Daniel chapter 6, that they came into play, mentioning King Darius and King Cyrus. They were the two kings of the Medo-Persian Empire that joined forces and became a great power and overthrew the nation of Babylon. Do you remember that? Well, here he describes it as a ram. It's not such a surprise, since the Medo-Persian Empire, in particular the Persian Empire, is the one who had the symbol in its ancient days of the symbol of a ram. In fact, you can go onto Google and type in Persian coins, or type in ancient Persian symbols or something like that, and click on images, and you will find the pictures of the ram that was the symbol of the ancient Persians. And this is not something that was unusual, probably even to Daniel, as they understood that the ram was symbolic of these people. God used this to describe them. All right, you call yourself a ram? Well, I'm going to use you in a prophecy. And you guys, though you may not know it yet, you're going to become so powerful that you're going to defeat the Babylonians. Now, Belshazzar was a Babylonian king. And so when he's reading this or seeing this in this vision, he's seeing the ram, and what he's understanding is the Medes and the Persians are going to take over. Well, he already knew this, remember, because of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And he had to interpret that dream. And so he understood that this was going to be the succession of nations, that one was going to take the other. That was God, and God is just driving this point home. But in this chapter, in the succeeding chapters, we're going to have greater detail of how that's going to happen, and even specific figures of it. And so, two horns. One horn is going to be higher than the other, and that's telling us that the one that comes after is the Persian Empire. They're going to be more powerful than the Medes were, and so they will eventually take over that power struggle there, or that power team that developed. Now in verse 4, I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And so here is talking about the power of this Medo-Persian Empire, and ultimately under King Cyrus, who became the Persian ruler over that time, and they were so powerful. Now, when I'm talking about this, Daniel's seeing it futuristically. We're looking backward. It's historic. We know this has happened. All of the secular history books tell us about this. This isn't just something the Bible dreamed up. There is verification of these things in the secular books, so we know this is already a done deal. And there were kings by the name of Darius. There was a king by the name of Darius. There was a king by the name of Cyrus. And these other kings, they all existed, and God is the one who orchestrated this whole thing. We come into verse 5, and as I was considering, he saw this picture of the ram, and he's thinking, wow, that is really something. He must have seen this in 3D, you know, with the glasses on and everything. He's watching 3D here. You know, isn't it funny how the 3D has become such a big deal? And those of you from my generation, remember when 3D came out? And we threw that thing out. We thought that was ridiculous, those goofy glasses. And these kids really think they've got something now with 3D. Been down that road. What's coming next? The 8-track? Been there, done that. Don't rush out and buy your 3D TVs just yet. Anyway, so Daniel's watching this whole thing, and he's seeing such a detail now. He's probably thinking, man, that's amazing, because this happened a couple hundred years later. This didn't happen right after he had this vision. This happened a little bit later. And so now, in verse 5, as he was considering this, suddenly he saw a male goat come from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Interesting figure here. Now, what does it mean? Okay, well, let's see. The Bible should be able to interpret itself. So, gee, I wonder what verse 21 will tell us. If you look at verse 21, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. So to assign any other interpretation is just a wrong interpretation. God wanted us to know who we're talking about here. Once again, we know clearly that we know who took over the Medo-Persian Empire, who conquered them. It was the Grecian Empire, the dynasty of the Greeks. They took over this great and powerful ram. And lo and behold, the Greeks of that day, even 200 years before Daniel, were known as the goat people. Guess what their symbol is when you type it into Google? Yes, a goat. And there are other symbols as well that they have, but the goat is prominent in their ancient imagery. And so, again, God knew what he was talking about. And I can imagine Daniel looking at this and seeing the goat, knowing that it's a nation and knowing that it's Greece, and going, they're going to become powerful? The goat people? That doesn't make sense. And I imagine he may have looked at this and thought, that's funny. They don't have any power. They're not strong right now. And to see in the future from where he was must have been really quite an amazing thing. Now, it says that this male goat is going to come from the west across the surface of the whole earth. Well, Greece was in the west and was going to sweep across the land, and it was going to do so quite quickly. You remember we saw these folks over in the seventh chapter as the leopard with the four wings, meaning a very swift creature. And so, excuse me, the four wings and the four wings and the four heads. And that's also, you're going to see, quite significant. Well, this had a notable horn. It had a goat had a notable horn between its eyes. There is one Greek who became a notable leader. Remember, we talked about him the last time when we were in chapter 7. Remember who that was? Anybody? Alexander the Great became the great conquering king, emperor of the Grecian Empire. And he was the one who actually conquered the Medo-Persian Empire. He swept through. He was the notable leader, or here he calls it the notable horn. Then in verse 6, he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Why not? This was a great, powerful nation. But see, it didn't matter because God said it was going to happen. It's the way God ordained it to be in his schedule of nations. This is the way it had to be. God orchestrated the whole thing. In his eye, his ability to know all things, he has already seen what is going to happen. That's where prophecy comes from. God already knows the future. He already sees it as already happening. And so in this particular case, it's not like he made it happen necessarily. He knew it was going to happen, and so it comes about. He may direct these things as well, and of course, as we believe that, but it seems he's already seen it, and so it will happen as such. In verse 8, therefore, the male goat grew very great. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, Alexander the Great, of course, was called the Great. He was the Great. That's who we know him as in all of history. But when he became, strong, the large horn was broken. Interesting. When he became strong, or at in his peak, he was broken. Alexander the Great was what, in that time, the conqueror of the known world, and died at the age of 33. Isn't that an amazing thing? So he was so at the peak of his strength, and bam, was cut off. Now, we know also historically, as it says here, and in place of it, in place of his that large horn, four notable horns came up toward the four winds of heaven. In other words, there was this one nation was divided into four. Look into any history book. They all talk about this, the division of the nation of Greece, or its dynasty. And they were all given different pieces. These four horns were the four generals that raised up out of Alexander's ranks to replace Alexander. Who could replace this great conquering king? Well, no, not one man, but four men took Alexander's place. And they all became the heads over four different regions or divisions of the Grecian Empire. And so, once again, all fulfilled history. We know that it already happened. It's a done deal. And we know also from chapter 7 that the kingdom was to be divided. And so this, again, is further detail. In verse 9, and out of one of them, one of the four horns, came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And so this glorious land is a reference, of course, of the Holy Land, the nation of Israel, but the glorious land also can include a lot of the what we would call Jordan today. All of that is considered, that whole region of that part of the Middle East, part of the glorious land. And it's interesting, this little horn that comes out of this four. And there are four different divisions. I should give you the divisions. One is Greece itself. That was one of the divisions. Asia Minor was another division. The Holy Land, or what some historians would call Palestine, not a biblical term, by the way, that is just what historians call it. And I know Yasser Arafat would like to call it that, and he knows better now. But it's considered, of course, God's land, the Holy Land. And then, of course, there is Egypt. And these are the four divisions, and each one of these generals had rule over them. Well, there was a fight between two of these leaders over the Holy Land region, which the Holy Land region was taken by Seleucus, who was the Seleucid kingdom or dynasty. They were the ones that gave birth to a great ruler, a great warrior by the name of Antiochus. Now, Antiochus was in a succession of Antiochus. This is, in fact, this little horn which grew was Antiochus the Fourth, and he, as I said, was in a succession of different Antiochuses, and he became the Fourth, and he grew exceedingly great toward the south, meaning he wanted to move toward Egypt. That is the south. He wanted to head toward the south where Ptolemy was actually ruling that place, and they wanted to, the Ptolemite dynasty, and they didn't take too kindly to his advances. Well, there was a great fight. He wound up at the top as the little horn springs out of the others. He became a little Attila, if you want to call him that. He became so full of himself and so great and so powerful that he, as Alexander became known as Alexander the Great, he became known as Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes, the word Antiochus literally means God manifested. Well, he became so full of himself that he became Epiphanes, or God manifested in the flesh, as it were. The word Epiphanes, of course, means, well, if you can imagine, epiphany, to have an epiphany. It's a little bit different than that. The word actually means illustrious. That's the word I was looking for. Wow. Whew. And it's, of course, a reference to deity. In his case, he believed himself to be a god. And we're going to see how that plays out historically as he goes on in verse 10. And it, this little horn, grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Now, the host of heaven, of course, usually refers to the angels, the stars, of, also referring to angels, meaning his audacity, his arrogance was so stinky that it raised up into the heavens. But he also killed even his own brothers in order to rise into power. So this is again historic, and we understand that. But he was he came into power by a murderous takeover, and so a very dangerous man. In fact, he is known as Antiochus Epiphanes. The Jews called him Antiochus Epimenes, which is a play on the word Epiphanes, and the word in the Greek means a madman. So Antiochus the madman is what the Jews like to refer to him as opposed to Antiochus the illustrious one. And so he was really a crazy guy. Now, verse 11, he even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. That's an interesting phrase. The prince of the host. In my Bible, prince is capitalized, or capital P, and is going to be significant in a bit. And by him, the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Now, we know historically what had happened. The Jews rebelled against Antiochus's advancements against the nations in the Holy Land area. And so there was one who was raised up by the name of Judas Maccabeus. Many of you old Catholics remember the book of the Maccabees. First and Second Maccabees tells the history of these particular wars. And of course, they are Old Testament apocryphal books. They were found in the Old Testament, of course, and of the Catholic Bible. You can go online and read them. They're just history books. They're not terrible things to read at all. And you might be interested to read about these things, but you'll find about Judas Maccabeus. A lot of history comes from this little story. In fact, the story of Hanukkah comes from that. If you know, the Jewish people this time of year just recently celebrated Hanukkah around the same time. And there's a reason that they did that, and we'll talk about it in just a minute. But here, this Antiochus Epiphanes actually caused the daily sacrifices to cease. What that means is he actually sent an army against the Jewish people, and he destroyed the temple. You notice it says there, the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Whose sanctuary? The prince of the host. His sanctuary was cast down. He destroyed it. And we know that Antiochus actually did that. He destroyed the temple. Some say, at least history tells us, or tradition tells us, that he actually sacrificed a pig on the altar. If you know anything about kosher rules and Jewish thinking, that is an abomination. It's a horrible thing. And so here, he causes the daily sacrifices to be taken away, meaning he stopped them from worshiping. You are no longer allowed to offer sacrifices to God, period. They were required to offer a sacrifice every morning and every evening. That was the law. And he caused it all to stop, and destroyed the temple and desecrated it with this action that is believed that he desecrated the temple by sacrificing a pig. You read about it in Daniel 9. You're going to read about it in chapter 11 and in chapter 12. Jesus spoke about it in Matthew chapter 24, and I think it's worth a read if I may just simply turn there. In verse 15 of chapter 24, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Now, it is believed here that, of course, what he does is he not only stops the sacrifices, but he prevents them from worshiping God in their own temple, in their own way, in their own liberty. It's very, very important sort of a piece of information here. This is historic. It has already happened in the sense that it happened in the Maccabean period. Of course, once he sacrificed that pig, then that's what caused the what is known as the Maccabean revolt. And Judas Maccabeus said, "Whoa, wait a minute. Now you've gone too far and you really got us upset." And so they actually went to war against Antiochus Epiphanes and fought him back. And so that is the miracle of lights. It is known as the Feast of Dedication in the Jewish rite. And in John chapter 10, Jesus attended the Feast of Dedication, meaning he celebrated Hanukkah. And that's something, it's the only reference in the Christian Bible to the Feast of Hanukkah or the celebration of Hanukkah. And it's in the New Testament, and of course, Jesus went to that celebration. A very interesting little piece of information. He never went to a Christmas celebration, but he did go to a Hanukkah celebration, just so you know. Of course, he was at the very first Christmas, but it was probably a different time of year. So a little piece of information there that I think is very, very interesting. Now, this probably happened around 168 or so BC, and so that's about the time period. So that's about 170 years or so before Jesus, and that's what you might keep in mind as far as the time frame of this. Now, in verse 12, "Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn," to this little horn, "to Antiochus Epiphanes, to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground." He did all this and prospered. Isn't that interesting? He cast truth down to the ground. He opposed the truth of God. And in opposing the truth of God, even in that opposition, he still prospered. Isn't that something? That it's possible to do that and think that you're being blessed. That seems to me God was just giving him enough rope to hang himself is what's happening. And I'm sure that this troubled Daniel, and it's troubling him because, God, how can you allow this to happen? How can you allow this evil, wicked guy to prosper over your people? And the bottom line is, as God would respond, well, they deserved it. They deserved it. See, prior to Antiochus defiling the temple, the Jewish people were defiling the temple. They were bringing in even the Grecian idols and gods and pagan worship practices into the region and even into the temple. We don't even have to remember what we saw in Ezekiel and what they were doing there, these atrocities, horrible things. Well, they hadn't learned. This is now, time had passed since those days, and yet they're still going to be practicing this evil, wicked idolatry. And so the answer to the question is, why does God allow that? Well, they deserved it. They deserved it. And so they were unfaithful to God, and God allowed this wicked man to come in and spank them once again. "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, 'How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?'" Now, two holy ones talking to one another. Who are these holy ones? Well, some have said that one of them is possibly Jesus himself. It is an appearance, or as they call a Christophany or a theophany, an appearance of Jesus in the Old Testament. We don't know specifically. It'd be nice to, I would assume that's the case. However, there is isn't enough evidence. Usually when we see a theophany, it's known as the angel of the Lord. And when we see that, then we can assume or suspect that is Jesus himself. Here, we're not sure. Anyway, we see that the question is asked by one of these holy ones, how long is the temple going to be desecrated? By the way, this is when the abomination of desolation takes place that Jesus referred to there in Matthew 24, that Jesus was basically saying in Matthew 24, you're going to see similar things happen in the last days. And Matthew 24 is all about the last days. And he said, in the last days, if you want to know what's going to happen, take a look at what happened in Daniel's day, what Daniel wrote about. That's what he's saying. That's the same thing. And in Daniel's day, we're seeing that, or what in Daniel's vision, what happened in the Maccabean period is that they were prevented from worshiping God. It's not a coincidence, folks, that the talk we're hearing on TV quite often these days is the war against Christianity. It's not a war against Christmas. It's a war against Christianity. And there is significance there. And the reason I say that is because, well, you know, we're standing up for what God holds as the righteous way of living. And we stand up and say, no, no, that's wrong. No, that's not, we can't go that way. We've got to do, and we'll talk against immorality, and we'll talk against abortion, and we'll talk against a lot of things that we feel are just terribly wrong for our country. And God can't bless a country that holds on to those things, and we'll go on our soapbox and we'll preach about it. I wonder if it's going to be against the law to do that someday, that they will actually make laws and say, you can't say those things anymore, which is in essence saying, you can't worship as you like. You can't worship the way that you used to be able to worship. And they will put laws in place to do that. Well, we saw it with Daniel, right? It's against the law to pray to anyone except the king. But he did anyway, and they threw him to the lion's den. And they even gave this Antiochus an army, as God was saying, you have an army, go and prevent them from worshiping you, from worshiping in their temple. And sure enough, they were. Well, we're possibly going to see that, perhaps even in our day, but certainly in the Great Tribulation period. Verse 14, and he said to me, here's the answer to the question, how long will this be? The answer is, for 2,300 days, and the sanctuary will be cleansed. Now, how long is that? 2,300 days. 2,300 days is about 7 years. Or the literal meaning of the word days is literally morning and evening. So the point is, if the Jews had to offer sacrifices in the morning and in the evening, then that's 2,300 days. Sacrifices, 2,300 sacrifices, meaning 1,150 morning sacrifices and 1,150 evening sacrifices. 7 years suddenly becomes 3.5 years. Sounds an awful lot like a tribulation period, unless at least what we understand to be in the future great tribulation that is about to come. And so we see that happening. And he says then at the end, you can look at it either way. I don't really know. In history, there are people, actually, you go online and you look at these things, there are people who have a lot of math that they've done, and they're certain that the math is going to add up, that it's 2, 3.5 years or 3 years, some will say. Others say, no, it's 7 years. And, you know, a lot of people get in trouble when they start doing math and Bible prophecy. You know, there is a fella, I know you've heard about him, who's predicting that May 21st, the world's coming to an end, the Lord's coming back. I can tell you one thing for sure. It's not going to happen May 21st. I know for two reasons. One, Jesus said, no man knows the day or the hour. So if he names a day, we know it's not that day. Right off the bat. And secondly, on May 22nd, we'll talk about it. And I can promise you, and we'll be here to talk about it. I hope he's right, though. I just know he's not. But you want to be careful when you start adding up. And just believe what Jesus said. Nobody knows the day and the hour. And don't pretend that Christians are in. Jesus doesn't even know or didn't even know when he was on this earth. Do you remember that? He didn't even know. What makes you think you're going to know? You're not going to know. We're going to know on the way up. And what we will know is that there are signs to look for. Signs that tells us, boy, we better get ready. And those signs are everywhere right now. May 21st? I hope so. But I'm certain it's not May 21st. Maybe May 20th. Could be. Could be the 18th, or it could be January 20th. So I know it could be in 20 minutes. We don't know. So that's the way I would rather look at it. But I'm certain it's not the 21st. So you can quote me on that if you want. And he said to me, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Now, we know when the sanctuary was cleansed, December 25th, 165 BC. Isn't that interesting? Kislev is the Hebrew month when it was actually cleansed. That's why Hanukkah moves. It's not always on our December 25th. Our calendar is 365 days. Jewish calendar is 360 days. And so it's always moving. That's why their Hanukkah has a different time than our December 25th. Kislev is a different time than our calendar. It's a whole different thing. So very interesting when you look at this. But historically, it happened just as we said. And it was Judas Maccabeus who actually cleansed the temple. And that whole miracle that happened, that tradition says happened with the oil, which kept burning miraculously. And that's where the Hanukkah lights come from. All of it's all part of that. It's an interesting little story there and fun. Well, this is all great stuff, but it says, Daniel, then it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. There you go. There's the angel Gabriel. Make him understand the vision, and I can expect him to say, you betcha. Remember, Gabriel's got some important stuff to announce to the world, right? He's been around. He spoke with Mary. He's a pretty highfalutin angel. And he's here, and he's talking to Daniel, but someone's giving him an order. Who do you suppose that one might be who's giving Gabriel the order? You know, Daniel, or Gabriel, make Daniel understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid, and I fell on my face. And he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. The time of the end? Wait a minute. If it happened in around 165 AD or BC, that's not the time of the end. How does this happen? Well, this is a bit of a lesson, if you will, if you want to call it that, that it's true both of the history or the past and the future. We call that, this is both the fulfillment of a near prophecy and a far prophecy. Theologically, in the prophetic world, it has a dual meaning. This becomes a picture of what's going to happen with the Antichrist. I don't know that it's significant. Antiochus is very close to our word Antichrist. It's a close thing. But the image that we see, especially in verses 9 through 14, that's exactly what the Antichrist is going to do in the tribulation period. It's not a coincidence that it's going to be 3 to 7 years that we're talking about in the tribulation period. In fact, when we get later on into the book of Daniel, we're going to see the tribulation period in greater detail, and he also gives us a numbering system there. So we're going to see it coming up very quickly. So it becomes now, Antiochus becomes not just a historical figure, but a historical type. As we see him as a type of Antichrist, which is coming in the future. So when Gabriel says this is a vision that refers to some time of the end, Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for the appointed time, the end, for at the appointed time, the end shall be. It's almost like he may be saying, look, man, what are you sleeping for? I'm trying to tell you something here. Why are you sleeping? Wake up. I have to tell you about what's coming at the end, the time of the indignation. And he says, the ram which you saw, having the two horns, they are the kings of the Media and Persia, kings of Media and Persia. The male goat is the kingdom of Greece. And the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. The first king, Alexander the Great. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. Of course not. It's going to be a divided nation. It's been weakened by its division. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Now, who's he talking about, Antiochus or the Antichrist? Both. He's talking about both. And through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart. Notice also it said earlier that his power is not from himself. There's a supernatural power at work here. And it says, he shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. But he shall be broken without human means. Interesting. And the vision of the evenings and mornings, there's the evenings and mornings, you see that? Which was told is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. Now, if I may, I just want to read a simple little passage that many have already ascribed to the Antichrist. This great prophecy of the Apostle Paul in 2 Thessalonians and chapter 2. In verse 3, let no one deceive you by any means, for that day, this last days, will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. Here we are talking about the Antichrist, not Antiochus. Antiochus happened already now a couple hundred years earlier. Now we're talking about someone in the future. And Paul is saying that this can't happen, that this falling away cannot happen. Many think the falling away may be an apostasy. Others think the falling away is the rapture. I don't know. We will see. Here he says that this day will not come, this last days period will not come until this man of sin has been exposed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple, showing himself that he is God. What did Antiochus Epiphanes mean? He was the illustrious one, the manifestation of the illustrious one, or God incarnate is what he would have called himself. And so here we see that the Antichrist is going to have the same characteristic. In verse 5, do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things, and now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time, for the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way, and then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume. Remember, he's going to be destroyed, but not by human hands. The Lord will consume him. Excuse me. With the breath of his mouth, and destroy the brightness of his coming, and with the brightness of his coming, the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth, so that they may be saved. Now, anyone who gets caught up in that time period, what Paul is saying is, well, you deserved it because you wouldn't come to the love of the truth so that you might be saved. So if you don't make it into heaven, there's nobody to blame but yourself. Absolutely no one else. You can say, well, I just don't believe it. Okay, fine. You don't have to. Just don't say we didn't tell you so. And you have to believe it if you want to go to heaven. And that's just the bottom line. And so these visions here that Daniel is having have a dual fulfillment. Of course, number one, the fulfillment of Antiochus Epiphanes. The Jews watched that happen over a couple of hundred years. And then we look to the future. Daniel will explain why there was a pause. We'll get to that in future chapters. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. Now, we love prophecy, right? We love prophecy. But we're not supposed to drop everything because of prophecy. Jesus said, make sure you occupy, do business until I return. Here, Daniel did the same thing. Imagine if the king, if he had failed at the king's business, and he would have said, Daniel, but what are you doing? You're falling down on the job here. Yeah, well, the Lord's coming back. Really? Let's stoke that fire again. Let's, throw him back into the lion's den or something. What are you, cuckoo? Get back over there and give me that cup of wine. But it seems so insignificant to give him the cup of wine. It seems so insignificant to do these piddly little stuff. You get back to work and do your business. You tell everyone you can along the way about Jesus. But you do your work, and you keep doing your work until the Lord comes back. And that's what we're supposed to do. And this is something that Daniel didn't understand. He says, I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. Well, it tells us in verse 26 why no one could understand it, because it was to be sealed up until the last days. It's for the days in the future. That's when understanding of these things will come. Are we in those days now? Well, I know we think we are. I know we think we are. And I believe we are. And I think that, as it tells us in Revelation, a couple places it tells us that in the last days, of course, the understanding will come. And in particular, in chapter 22, verse 10, do not seal the sayings of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. I believe the time is at hand. And that's why we're able to look back at the history. And I believe the time is now, because something happened that made everything fall into place. And that something was the rebirth of the nation of Israel. That is something that no one else had. Most of the old writers of old, the prophecy, those who tried to understand prophecy, could never even imagine Israel becoming a nation again. Exactly as Isaiah prophesied, exactly as Ezekiel prophesied, exactly as Jeremiah prophesied, exactly as God said. Listen, that's why we have to know the Word of God and commit ourselves to it, because what it says is truth. Now, the world, the devil, is trying to oppose this truth and trying to put this truth down. We have to become lovers of this truth. We have to become expert at this truth, livers of this truth. Livers? Yeah. Livers. We have to become kidneys of this truth. And gallbladders of this. We have to keep living this truth, because there is no other truth. And it's not just that it's true because we say it's true. It's true because we know it's true. We've seen it. Look at the history. God said, these are the nations. They're going to come in line. You're going to see it all. Oh, we're going to see more. This is just chapter 8. We're going to get into 9 and 10 and 11 and 12. You're going to see a lot more that God said, and now we see, looking back. And so he's saying, but don't forget, there's more to come. So we're really kind of cuckoo if we don't believe that there's something coming. We're just in denial. So we know something is coming. We may not know all of the details. Some of us think we know the details, but something is coming. And so what we need to do is prepare for the coming of the Lord. And that's why prophecy is so important. And we can't ignore it. We have to study it, even if we scratch our heads and say, gee, what in the world does it mean? In the right time, God's going to give us the revelation that we need, that we need. So, you know, I made fun of the guy who says Jesus is coming in May of 2011, May 21st, 2011. I don't fault him for wanting to be right about that. You just don't have the right to claim a day. You're claiming special knowledge that you just don't have. And unfortunately, he's in error. And unfortunately, the guy is predicting it's not the first time he's done it. So anyone who believes him, shame on you. You deserve it. You deserve it. He's predicted it far too many times and has been wrong. So don't believe it. This is what we believe. This is the truth. This is what we believe. Amen? Amen. Bless us, O Lord, as we study your word. We're feeble, weak-minded people, but your word puts us right. Your word transforms us and makes us new. And the more and more we give ourselves to your word, the wiser we become, and that's what we want to do. And we're all in process here. We're all in process of becoming more like Christ, and you're working in our hearts. So we commit ourselves to you. Lord, we want to be excited about your return, not foolish, but excited. And we're looking for you to come again. In the meantime, make us faithful in all things. And Lord, if there's someone who is here tonight or listening tonight who does not know Jesus yet, oh Lord, please, please let them see the urgency of the day. Let them see the urgency of this moment as they hear your voice, that they would surrender to you. And if you're hearing his voice, then talk to him now. Give him your heart. Give him your life. Surrender. In Jesus' name, amen.